Time to take a look at your taxes here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, and pleased to welcome back Mary Mellum to talk about filing your 2019 tax returns. Mary's business is Eshwabenon Tax Professionals. She and her husband, David, have been in the tax business for more than 30 years. They serve individuals, they consult to tax professionals, and they teach tax seminars across the country. So how do you plan to file your taxes this year? Will you take the standard deduction, or are you going to be like me and itemize? I hope you'll join in the conversation. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Mary, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Let's start out by talking about that standard deduction versus itemizing, the differences and so forth.
Well, the standard deduction is a flat dollar amount that is given to any filing status. Single, head of household, married filing joint, they each have a number attached to them. The single, for instance, is $12,200 for this year. And it's a big dollar amount. And itemized deductions need to be greater than that amount in order to benefit the taxpayer. The hard part of it is people see that $12,200 single for the single person and think, well, I'm never going to get over that. But it also, they have to keep in mind the state of Wisconsin, because sometimes they may not need that much to benefit them as a state itemized deduction credit. So they shouldn't totally discount those numbers for other purposes.
Yeah, that makes some sense, really. I guess drawback would be on an itemized, you know, if you don't make the 12,000 threshold, if you're just about there, would it still pay maybe to do it anyway because of the state situation?
You should always put the numbers in. If you're doing the return yourself, I assume your software that you would do it through would allow you to put that in, and the software would choose which one gives you better benefit for the federal return. And then you would have those numbers in there that typically software will take those numbers from the federal or the input screen and put them in the proper places on the state of Wisconsin.
Okay. And that did increase a little bit this year, the standard deduction, didn't it?
Yes, went from a nice round 12,000 to 12,002, and for the married joint without age or blindness added to it, went from 24,000 to 24,400. So a small increase due to inflation.
And there's a new question on the tax return involving virtual currency. Tell us about that.
There is on the top of the Schedule 1, which is the schedule that has the extra income that's not on the front page of the tax return or the extra adjustment items, on the top of that return, it asks everyone the question, do you have anything to do with virtual currency? And from a technical standpoint, the question asks, did you receive, send, sell, send, exchange, or acquire any interest in virtual currency? And many people say no, because they have no idea what virtual currency is. But virtual currency is a private currency. Similar to government currency, which we're all used to the U.S. dollar, and that's how we fill out our tax return. And in the past, we sometimes have people that work in foreign countries and receive money in foreign dollars or invest in foreign countries, and that money has to be converted into U.S. dollars in order to make its way onto the tax return. The same thing is this virtual currency. There are companies that accept virtual currency. There are people who buy or acquire virtual currency and hold it in hopes, like any other investment, that it goes up in value. And those things that they do with the virtual currency translate into tax situations. And it has to be converted from whatever that currency is to the U.S. dollar. And there are different websites that allow you to do that.
Yeah. Wow.
But the IRS is deciding that, like the cash economy, it's something that they have to monitor or they will be losing tax dollars.
Yeah, I would guess so. Well, if you're in another country for a year, but you're planning to come back, you don't need to put that money onto your tax accounts, do you?
Oh, yes. If you are a U.S. citizen or a resident alien, you are taxed on your worldwide income. However, in certain circumstances, if you work in a foreign country, there is something called a foreign earned income exclusion that you can take part in, and it allows you to earn a certain amount of money in the foreign country without having to pay taxes on it. But there are certain forms. You must report the income and invoke or elect the exclusion by using a Form 2555 to report that.
All right, that makes sense. We have callers online. Maybe we should take some calls here. Charles in Mount Horeb up first. Charles, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is about the need to report inheritance. I understand that there's no tax on the inheritance for the recipient, but maybe that's not universally true. And even with no tax on it, do we still need to report that on a form somewhere?
That's a very good question, Charles. It depends on what you inherit, whether it's taxable. If you inherit stuff like house, stock, vehicles, the inheritance of that is not a taxable event. And in fact, your cost basis, as we call it, is the fair market value at the date of the person's death that gave you that property. But there are other types of property which will reflect a taxable event. Those types of property, we call them income in respect of a decedent, but technically it's anything that the decedent would have had to pay taxes on had they received it. And the biggest thing with that is retirement plans or IRAs. If you are the beneficiary of a decedent's retirement or IRA, it is going to be taxable to you in the same way that it was taxable to the decedent.
All right. Does that make sense, Charles?
I think so. So regarding the IRA, if we cash out the IRA entirely, then we pay a tax on those funds.
That is correct.
As if it were regular income. If we leave the IRA where it is and take the RMD each year, then we pay tax on that RMD.
That is correct.
I guess a question about the RMD. Do we have to take the RMD based on the age of the decedent, or do we take it based on our age?
That's a very interesting question that you brought up. For 2019, there is one set of rules. For 2020, there is a new set of rules that comes along. The old set of rules, if this happened in 2019, you would have had to take out the RMD generally based on the life expectancy of the recipient, the beneficiary. There are a couple of little glitches that say if the beneficiary is older than the decedent, it might be over the decedent's life, but generally it was over the life of the recipient. For 2020, those rules are changing as a general course of event, and that says that there's no longer what we call the stretch benefit. And if you receive an IRA or a pension fund, the general rule for 2020 is that it has to be taken within 10 years.
But now in Charles' case, since he's got it in 2019, will the 2019 rules apply even in 2020?
Yes.
Yeah, well, they will. Okay.
It will start wherever you are in the start of this. is how the rules will apply. And for the 2020 rules, there are some special rules for the spouse. There are special rules if the recipient is a minor. So the general rule is what I gave you, but there are always exceptions with rules.
Okay. There you go, Charles. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Daniel in Milwaukee, we'll go to you next. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. Thanks for being there.
Sure. Glad to have you on the air. What's on your mind?
My wife and I had half interest in a duplex rental property with our son, and we sold it this year. We owned it for 4 years. And I saw some articles online that if your income was under $77,000, you would not have to pay capital gains. But it's not coming out that way when I put the numbers into TurboTax. Do I owe capital gains on that sale of that duplex?
Generally, the $77,000 that you are referring to represents the zero tax rate for capital gains. The sale is reportable, definitely, and it's reportable on a Form 4797. And if you have a gain that goes over to Schedule D and there is room, it's not the gain of $77,000, but you're looking at your total income of $77,000. And to the extent that the gain comes in that bracket after considering your other income, that part of it may be subject to 0% capital gain rate, and anything above that is subject to a 15 or a 20% rate. So I don't know if you're looking at the gain on the sale and looking at that $77,000 or your overall tax return.
Well, I was thinking that my overall tax return, our income was $63,000. Of course, we made a profit, and that took us over $77,000.
Okay, if your profit takes you over $77,000, you may have that excess taxed at the 15% rate. So that may be why you're coming up with a tax on some of the profit.
Ah, all right, that makes sense. Daniel, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. John in Appleton, your turn.
Yes, good morning, Larry. In 2019, due to some medical costs, my itemized deductions are going to far exceed the 24-4. In fact, my itemized deductions are going to exceed my adjusted income for the year. My question for the tax expert, is there any way to defer some of those itemized deductions to a following year to get the maximum benefit?
In terms of medical expenses, the answer is no unless you defer paying them until the next year. And if you've already paid them, you can't turn the clock back. So the answer to that is no. But there is something that might be able to be deferred if you gave charitable contributions in the same year and your income is being offset. The charitable contributions will carry over, not the medical, but the charitable.
Oh.
That helps.
Yeah, that could be a big help. John, thanks.
And I assume I could find the information on how to do this within the tax instructions, or would my software help me with that?
I think the answer to that is yes to both questions. Your software may be doing it already for you, but you can look at, there's a publication on charitable contributions, or the instructions to the Schedule A may also discuss part of that.
All right. Good luck, John. Thank you so much for calling. Mary Mellum, our guest today, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals, our guest for the entire show today. Jana Rose, our on-air producer today. Nigel O'Shea, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your taxes for 2019, Larry Mueller here with my guest Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Question for her, give a call at 1-800-642-1000. 800-642-1234. We've got open lines to get you on pretty quickly. 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@WPR.org. And let's take another call. Sherman in Bruce, Wisconsin. It's your turn. Hi, Sherman.
Hi. Couple of questions. Is there any kind of state or federal deductions for contributing to a grandchild's 529 account?
The answer to the federal side of it is no. The answer to the state side of it is yes, that you are able to put into a child's 529 plan, it is, I believe, about $3,200 this year that you are able to contribute to the 529 plan. That number changes each year, but to take a deduction on your state return for that, for the amount that you put into that child's 529 plan.
Advantageous to keep the 529 in my account, or should I change it to my grandchild's account?
If you want to have control over it, it's good to have it in your name. The child could also have a 529 plan in their own name. So at the cost of college being what it is today, children can have more than one 529 plan. The advantage of having it in your name is that you control the money. So if that child doesn't go to college and there is another child, it can be rolled over. I mean, it can be that way in anybody's, whoever controls the amount. But you would have control of it if you leave it in your name for the benefit of your grandchild.
Okay, does that help, Sherman? All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Take some more calls here, too. Actually, we had an email from Jim from Merton, going back to IRAs for a minute. Wondered your thoughts on the self-directed IRA, specifically Silver, and the tax reporting involved there.
There are rules that allow self-directed IRAs, and basically, the self-directed part of it says that I have the right to decide what goes into my account. Silver comes in a lot of different mediums. You can own mutual funds that invest in silver. You can invest in the actual hard metal. Self-directed, you still have to have a custodian that holds on to the investment for you. So it really isn't any different than any other kind of an investment. It's just that you have control about who makes the decision about what goes into that IRA.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, let's go to Cindy in Middleton then. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. So I moved to Wisconsin from Illinois in September of 2019, and my husband and I have always filed married filing separate because of my student loans and just having my income considered for student loans, PDAC. But he worked in Illinois for all of 2019. He didn't move up until January of this year. But when I fill out my tax return, it keeps asking me to fill out the community property form and saying that I can't move forward until I do that. But it's confusing to me because he hasn't lived in Wisconsin for the year of 2019. Can you provide any clarity on that?
If you live in Wisconsin and he is a resident of Illinois, community property is not involved. So you file married separate based on your income only for that purpose. So I don't know what box is being checked or not checked on it, but there is no community property for you in the situation that you're describing.
Okay, perfect. So thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
No problem.
Bob in Kewaunee, your turn now. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, good morning. I've got a question on some stocks that I sold last year. I'm fairly low income. Without the sale of the stocks, I made roughly $17,500 last year in income. I sold some stocks for a little bit over $4,000, something that I've had for years. I mean, probably 50 years. It was something that I got from my grandfather a long, long time ago. And I'm trying to figure out how do I do that? Do I declare it as income? Do I declare it as capital gains? Or do I pay taxes on capital gains with that kind of income, federal or state or both?
Okay, first of all, Bob, since you are over the filing requirement, over the $12,200, you're required to file a tax return and report it on the tax return. The $4,000, since you've held it long-term, the $4,000 stock sale belongs eventually on the Schedule D. There's an 8949 form that it starts on. If you have no record of basis, the $4,000 goes into income. But as an individual, when you calculate the income, because you are in a lower tax bracket, chances are the gain on the sale falls into the 0% tax bracket. And with that being said, it probably will not generate any other income tax for the $4,000. Since you're over the tax over the standard deduction, your other income could be subject to tax.
Yeah, the Social Security. I'm 69 years old.
Does
that make a difference?
Is your $17,500 all Social Security, not other kinds of income?
No, about $13,000 or $12,000 of that is Social Security.
Chances are you're not going to pay any taxes.
Still need to file, and you know, I'm not sure based on income, there may be some opportunities on the state side to receive some benefits. Or am I way off on that, Mary?
On the homestead credit, if your income is under 24,000, I believe it's 24, either 6 or 24,900. If your total household income is under that number, there is an opportunity for a homestead credit, which is based on either the rent you pay or the property taxes for the home you own that you live in as your principal residence. So sometimes there's a reason to file even though you're not required to file.
Yeah, makes sense. Bob, does that help?
Yes, it does. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you for calling. You can join in, too. Open lines get you on real quick at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of emails, Lisa from East Troy emailed to ask about hobbies, writing off hobbies, if you've earned income from them. Lisa has earned some money from horse shows. She wonders if she can deduct her costs for this hobby. What's the difference between this and self-employment where you deduct all your expenses?
That's a very good question. And because of the Tax Act in 2017, the rules for hobby changed. And what I mean is the expense side. Hobby income is reportable as other income, and this year the line that you reported on changed also. It used to be line 21 on the front page of the tax return. Last year it was line 21 on the Schedule 1. This year it is on the Schedule 1, and they've renumbered the line, so it shows up on line 8, I believe. But it is other income. Unfortunately, the expenses related to a hobby were deductible as miscellaneous itemized deductions subject to 2%. And so since those deductions are gone, the hobby income is income and very little, you know, there are no deductions against it. So as far as that kind of thing, you're reporting the income, which you're required to do, and there's no place to take the deductions. There's a difference between a hobby and a business. A hobby is something you do for fun and have really no real concept of growing the business and making a profit on it. A business is something that is regular and continuous, and you are hopefully making a profit at some time in the future. Also, a business, differing from a hobby, if it is profitable, is subject to self-employment tax.
All right. There we go. So, sounds like Lisa from East Troy is out of luck in terms of deductions on those income, on those expenses. Judy in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I have a question about a 1099-Q that my 19-year-old grandson got. He had 529 plans set up in his name. Well, it was actually set up in his father's name. He was the beneficiary of it. And the 529 paid certain educational expenses directly to the university this fall and this spring. But now he gets the 1099-Q, and he doesn't know if he has to put that on his tax return. He uses the very simplest one because all he has is, like, part-time work. And if he does, how does he demonstrate that he doesn't owe taxes on it because it was all used for tuition and fees?
It's a good question. The 529, occasionally you see the 529 distributions come out to the person who is the owner of the account. And in some cases, you see the 529 distributions coming out to the person who's the beneficiary. I'm not exactly positive of why it goes both which places, but because the child has the 529 distribution in their name, they're responsible for reporting any gain that might come as a result of it. The 529 rules say that as long as you use the income or the distribution for qualified educational expenses, there is no tax on that income. And the problem comes in because there is an education credit that kind of comes first, that might use the expenses that you would otherwise, that you use to pay with that. And so if there are only a certain amount of expenses, or if the 529 was used to pay for tuition and someone is claiming the credit, it may not look like all of that money was used for education. Therefore, a ratio of the amount not used to the total amount taken out, that times the earnings on it is what's subject to tax and subject to a 10% penalty. So it depends on if this child is a dependent. Mom and dad everybody has to get together, look at all of the expenses that were paid for education, whether out of that account or not, and decide what the what the tax consequences are. The IRS doesn't have a particular form that shows you how to report it because there isn't, so that other income line 8 is the one that we kind of try to show that distribution so the IRS sees it, and then also make it taxable or non-taxable to the extent that it is.
Okay. Judy, does that help?
Doesn't help me, but I'm not the one ultimately responsible. But I think what it proves is that they need to consult a tax preparer this year at least to know what they're doing.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, I do too. Judy, I've got that to look forward to next year when my daughter starts college somewhere. Oh, boy. Thank you again for calling. Let's go to Glenn in Middleton. Hi, Glenn.
Hello. Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have some income from consulting that I do, and the consulting very occasionally requires me to travel overnight, and I deduct the airfare and the hotel costs. But I have a little confusion about the meal costs and the 50% rule. So I know that I can either have precise records that I keep of my meal costs, or I can use a standard daily allowance that the government sets. And If I use the standard daily allowance for the particular location for meals, then do I multiply that by 50, you know, 0.5 and use that amount as the deductible amount? Or if I'm using the standard daily allowance, does that 50% rule still apply?
It's a very good question. The meal allowance, whichever number, the actual expenses or the standard meal allowance, is multiplied by the 50%, and it's the 50% of that number that is a deduction on your tax return. The only thing that I would caution you about the standard meal allowance, it is overnight travel, and the number that you use associated with the city that you are sleeping in is the number that you use for that night. So if you are gone two nights, if you're gone overnight, the first day will be the city that you're at when you've traveled out. The second day, the number you will use is associated not with that city, but the city that you return home to at night. So sometimes that gets a little confusing.
Yeah, it does. Glenn, does that help?
The city you depart from and the city you return from on a one-day trip, not the city you stayed in.
Right.
No. Where did you sleep the night that you had meal expenses? The first night is the city you're traveling to. The second night, you're going to be using your home city. So, for instance, you go to Washington, D.C. overnight and come back to Green Bay. The first night, the meal allowance will be based on the Washington, D.C. number. The second night, it will be based on the Green Bay number.
Thanks very much. Very helpful.
All right. Thanks, Glenn. Appreciate your call. Well, Paul in Solon Springs has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Question. My wife and I live in Wisconsin. Our granddaughter, who is 17 years old, has lived with us full-time for more than a year. Can we claim her as a dependent?
My answer to that generally is yes. She is what we call a qualifying child of yours, and she lived with you for more than half the year. As long as there is no one else beside you that can also meet that definition, you're fine. And what I mean by that is if your daughter or son also lived with you for that time, the child could be a qualifying child of both of you, and the parent always gets the first crack at it, so to speak.
Okay. So, but if the granddaughter was there on her own for a year, then I guess the main thing you need to worry about is making sure that one of the other parents doesn't also try to claim the child as a dependent.
Yes, there is only one Social Security number per dependent that will be allowed on a tax return. And there are rules, but sometimes the rules get messed up. But based on what you've said, she is a qualifying child of yours, and that would give you the right to claim her.
All right. Paul, I hope that helps.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. Irvin in Burnett will go to you now. Hi, Irvin.
Yes, I have a question on a non-qualified tax-deferred annuity. If there's a date that I have to start withdrawing from it, and if the first money out would be all the money that was tax deferred.
Okay. Your non-qualified annuities, generally up to this year, annuities for retirement distributions, generally the year that you had to start taking it out is 70 and a half. Your non-qualified annuities are a contract generally, and they have a year, a length of the contract, and then at the end of the contract, you have to do something with it. It might be roll it over. It might be annuitize it. So if it is not a retirement contract, then I think you have to look at the contract itself. And at that time, either roll it over into something else, or if it gets into the annuity phase, then it comes out at a certain amount each period. And when you are in the annuity phase, part of it will be earnings and part of it will be a return of your principal.
Ah, there we go. Irvin, thank you very much for calling. Dennis in Elizabeth, Illinois, your turn.
Good morning. Thanks for having the show. Great show today.
Thank you.
So I got a question on Schedule F income. With the farm situation where it's been over the last several years, some years show a profit and some years show a net operating loss. My question is, I know that they carry forward at least for a period of time, but do any of those older losses, do they eventually expire, or is there any time limit on how long you can carry those over?
There is two sets of rules that come into play with the farm, with the net operating losses. In 2017, the rules changed. Prior to that time, you carried it back 2 years and forward 20 years. Those net operating losses that were in existence prior to the change of 2000, the change took effect in 2018. Those prior to that time will expire as they reach the 20-year carry forward period. The new NOLs created after the law change do not expire, but must be carried forward.
Dennis, does that help?
Yeah, helps very much. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin. She and her husband David operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Great to have her with us. Certainly looking forward to your tax questions as well. You can call us right now at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your taxes for 2019 today, we could probably look ahead to 2020 as well with our tax expert, Mary Mellum. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals in the Green Bay area, enrolled agents, and they even teach seminars to other tax professionals across the country. Questions for her, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Randy from Wisconsin Rapids called. His mother lived through the entire year of 2019 and then passed away in January of this year, and wonders how he should file taxes for his mother.
When a person dies, their tax year ends. If his mother died, I believe she said in 2020?
Yes.
Okay. So for all of 2019, Mom was alive, and Mom would file just as if she were here to do it herself. Her personal representative is the one that would be responsible for filing the tax return, or which could be her spouse if she's married, if the spouse is surviving. But someone needs to file it for 2019. For 2020, it would depend on how much income she has, that she may not be over the filing requirement and no tax return would be required to file. Again, it depends on, sometimes there's a reason to file it. And in 2020, I like to see people filing the final return kind of to close the books on things, even if it's not required. But I want to mention something. Sometimes there is a lower income person who is filing for homestead, the homestead credit that we talked about earlier. In order to file for homestead, you must be alive at the time you file the claim.
So if mom had a homestead credit that she had been getting, and in 19 she would have gotten that homestead credit, if she's not alive when that return is filed, the homestead credit will not be allowed.
Ah, okay. Well, we have Roberta in Princeton, Wisconsin. Let's go there. Hi, Roberta.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have two quick questions. We put money into CDs for our grandchildren. There's three grandchildren. They're 13 and younger, and they're a three-year CD. So who pays the taxes on that?
It depends on whose name those CDs are in. If they are in your...
They're in the children's, yeah.
If they're in the children's name, then the children's Social Security number would have had to have been given to give those accounts, and the children will be responsible for the earnings on it.
The children would be.
If they're in the Social Security number of the children, then yes. And many children at that age don't have to file a return, so it may not be a consequence. It just depends on how large the earnings are.
Okay, not that large. So
okay.
And then the other thing is my husband's 85 and I'm 73, so how many deductions can we take ourselves?
Your standard deduction is the 24.4, plus you get one for age and one. I'm assuming that neither of you are blind.
No.
Okay. So it would be roughly an extra $3,000, just under that. So I believe your standard deduction is going to be $27,000 for the two of you under that situation.
All right.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Roberta. Dan in Madison, your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Yes, my daughter is going back to school, and I'm basically paying for her tuition and room and board. And she's 28 years old, and I was wondering if there's any tax advantages that I can take to try and mitigate some of the expenses, or she could do.
If your daughter is age 28, she's no longer a qualifying child of yours. Does your daughter work?
Right now she is not working, but she has worked part-time, and she will be getting another part-time job, yes.
Okay. If your daughter makes over roughly $4,000, she is not going to qualify as a dependent of yours. So basically, you get nothing for the education expenses. She, on the other hand, could claim that towards an education credit, again, depending on where she is in school and what credit applies to her. But it would be a gift that you're making to her if she is not qualified as your dependent.
All right. There we go, Dan. Thank you for calling. Vern in Coleman, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Vern.
Thank you for taking my call. I have two LLCs that I passed my income through to myself via 1065 K-1. With the new tax law, well, last year's tax law, I can deduct 20%. Question on that, can I deduct that before paying the FICA, the Social Security and Medicare?
No. The FICA and Medicare is not affected by the 20% deduction.
Okay, I paid it correctly last year, and they sent me a big check, and I thought I did it wrong, so I think I did. There's no real block for doing that 20%. Do I transfer?
There is, and this year they have created a new form. It's called QBI, Qualified Business Income Deduction, and on the tax return you'll find the line for it directly after the standard deduction line. And there is a form that the IRS created to calculate that deduction.
Did you know what the form number is offhand?
I will look it up. I'm not sure. I don't want to give you the form number off the top of my head because I will give you the wrong number.
Vern, we've got a news break coming up in 5 minutes, and that may give Mary some time to look.
Okay, I'll just listen to the radio if you...
All right.
That sounds
over
fine.
There, and I'll write it down later.
All right, thanks,
that
Vern.
Sounds great.
Linda in Madison, your turn. Hi, Linda.
Thank you. I really appreciate this show. It's very beneficial. My husband and I are both over 74, and so every year we have to take that RMD distribution. Would you suggest any ways to take that? I mean, the income or the interest rates for now are so low. Would you suggest anywhere to put that if we're not going to go on a trip or something like that to reinvest it?
That is a, you know, it depends on your investment strategy. And that's really a broker question. If the banks aren't paying as much interest, there's always alternatives like either bonds or owning stock that pays dividends. So I would recommend that you talk to a broker, and they could give you better advice than from the tax standpoint.
Yeah. One other tip that you had on another show, Mary, involved with the RMD, is if you were, let's say you're giving something to money to the church every year, couldn't you put that money toward that contribution?
Yeah. Each year, an individual is allowed to contribute their IRAs, the RMD from their IRA, directly to a charity. It has to be a direct transfer from the custodial account to the charity, and up to $100,000 could be directed that way. And that means that they do not pay taxes on it and do not get an additional charitable deduction, but it lowers your AGI and saves tax in that realm as well.
So something else to consider for people in that
Certainly
situation.
If you're making charitable contributions, you can do them directly from your IRA and possibly save yourself some tax. Back to the prior caller about the qualified business income deduction. The form is Form 8995, and if you're looking at the current tax return, it's line 10 on the front page of the 1040 return.
All right. There we go. And Linda, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Robert in Plover, your turn. Hi, Robert.
Good morning. Great show and great answers. I understand that my wife and I can move into our out-of-state rental house for 2 years and then sell it within 5 years without owing any capital gains tax if the gain is less than $500,000. So if we did that, can we later sell our Wisconsin home and then also have that exclusion on the capital gains? And would we have to wait, or we have to do it in a certain period of time?
Okay. First of all, what you're talking about is what we call the 121 exclusion. And the 121 exclusion says that if I own a home as my principal residence and I have lived in it at least 2 out of the last 5 years, when I sell it, I will not pay taxes on it generally, as long as my gain is under $250,000 for a single and $250,000 for a married couple. So that's the rule you're talking about. So if I sell one house in 2 years, move into the second one, establish it as my principal residence, sell it after that time, I still have another exclusion for the next residence that I live in for 2 years. So the answer to your question is kind of yes, but my concern is what you said about being out-of-state rental. You can do that, first of all, if you change your principal residence to the out-of-state rental. So wherever that state is, you would have to establish your residence in that state and make that your principal residence for that to qualify. And then for your other home to qualify, you would have to move back and reestablish residence for the 2 years in the other state.
That makes sense, for sure.
Okay.
Also, with a rental property, there could be one other little challenge. If the gain from a rental, if you have taken depreciation on that rental, some of that gain due to the depreciation may be taxable, even though you can exclude most of it.
Okay, you wouldn't be able to exclude in your gain the depreciation you took on the rental.
That's correct. That you can take as much of the exclusion, but you cannot exclude the gain on the rental because it's taxable gain. So you can't use that much of the exclusion to exclude the gain that is due to the depreciation that was taken. Certainly the appreciation, but you've got to deal with the depreciation on the rental.
There you go, Robert. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Lots of great questions today and lots of wonderful answers as well from our guest, Mary Mellum, tax professional from Ashwaubenon, and she and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. She's going to be with us up to 12:30 today, but we will take a look at the news now, the weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back. Mark from Madison, stay with us. You can join in too, 1-800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at filing your taxes on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Mary and her husband, David, have been in the tax business for more than 30 years. They serve individuals, consult to tax professionals, and teach tax seminars around the country. Great to have you listening in. We have all our phone lines filled right at the moment, and I will let you know that you could email us at ideas@wpr.org. But Mary, let's just go right back to the phones and to Mark in Madison. Mark, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call. So I have a small business that I have and I bought a computer that costs about $3,000. Do I have to depreciate it over years, or can I just do it over 1 year? I've been able to do that in the past, but I'm not finding that this year that I could do that. Can you tell me that?
The answer is yes, you can. It is a depreciable asset because it has a life longer than a year. However, we have two programs, one called bonus depreciation and one called 179. Expensing. And through either of those programs, you would be able to write a depreciable asset of this type off entirely in 1 year.
So I just put it under a form that's 179, or do I just put it under business supplies?
No. You would go to the depreciation form and you would set it up as a depreciable asset, but you are not electing out of bonus depreciation, which is the default, which would give you 100% write-off for it, or you can make an election to take 179 expensing, but you would do it through the depreciation form, the 4562 form.
That makes sense.
Thank you much.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. Faye in Tomahawk, your turn. Hi, Faye.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
I have a question. My daughter turned 17 last year, and obviously we claim her. But she had her first job last year, and she has a W-2 from that job. She had a second job last year, though, which was coaching figure skating for our local club, which we have a 1099 miscellaneous for. And then she also does do private coaching, which she got paid cash, and we're not sure how to go about filing for her.
Well, first of all, if she has received more than $400 from the coaching and private lessons activity, she's required to file a tax return because she's subject to self-employment tax. I would say she is in it as a business rather than just as a hobby. So that means that she would have that income would go on a Schedule C as income, and then her W-2 income would be reported just as wages. So those are the things you would have to do. If there were any expenses relating to her coaching activity, uniforms, tools, books, anything special that she acquired to do her job, she could report those as deductions against that. maybe she bought special skates, she could write the skates off towards the business if it's something related to the business itself.
What about travel from her home to the ice rink?
Travel from your home to the ice rink, generally, if everything goes on at the ice rink, would be a commuting expense, and commuting is non-deductible.
Okay.
But if she had other places that are not her normal place of business that she had to travel, or overnight to coach at some kind of a special activity, then you have your travel expenses that would be allowed.
Okay. Faye, does that help?
Okay. That helps. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sue and Madison, your turn. Hi, Sue.
Thank you, Larry and Mary. Larry, this is Sue at Design Coalition Institute. I was on your show as a guest a couple of months ago with Chad.
Yeah, hi, Sue.
Thank you so much. Yeah, so following up on that conversation we had, we talked about accessory dwelling units, you know, granny flats, in-law apartments, garage apartments, that sort of thing. And I'm recently learning that families who are keeping a loved one, whether it's granny or an adult child with disabilities or whatnot, and have built or added an ADU suite for that family member, if they follow certain rules, that they also can take advantage of all the rental deductions, utilities, and depreciation, and all that sort of thing. And I would like to hear some clarification on that.
All right. Mary?
Okay. If they are truly renting out that particular part to the family, you know, to a family, and they're receiving fair rental value, then you can take, and it is the primary residence of that person, then you could treat it as a rental. If they are using the home of the person in addition to that, it would only be that particular. We get into the bed and breakfast kind of rules or the daycare rules where you're only using that particular part of it. So I would recommend that you get some advice because those rules can be tricky. And if you're not renting at fair rental value, then it may not be deductible at all.
Hmm.
So, again, tricky rules when it becomes family that you're renting to, and especially if it's under fair rental value. You may not be able to get, like the normal rental to a non-related party where you get a loss that you're able to offset other parts of your income. There's more things to it than just, I have a rental.
Yeah, there we go. Sue, thanks. Appreciate the call. Nancy and Madison, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Thank you. My question is regards to my mother, who we sold her house, and she was getting homestead credits, so now that's all gone. Her only income is Social Security, and her tax person said she wouldn't have to file anymore because that's all she is getting. She gets no other income, but that makes me nervous. So is that really true?
It is really true. If you are receiving Social Security and that's your entire income, there is no need to file a tax return. And if you are not paying rent, is your mother living with you that she's not paying rent with that Social Security?
No, she's not.
She is not paying rent where she is, so then homestead.
She's living with me, and so she's not paying rent to live with me, no.
Okay. And so if that's the case, there's no need for her to file a tax return. And it's really okay not to file a tax return if there's no need to do it. And it's a hard step to take.
Yeah. And she's been doing it for 96 years or whatever. I guess I could see, well, at least probably 80 years. It's probably a hard thing to do, but what the heck? She's 96. She's earned it. There you go, yeah. Nancy.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. All right. Joan in Wood County. It's your turn. Hi, Joan.
Thank you. See, this concerns the
traditional IRA conversion over to a Roth, if I only converted a portion of the traditional IRA into that Roth this year or last year, but when I put into the traditional IRA up to a certain point, it was deductible off of my regular income. But at a certain point, it was not because of whatever income I had. You couldn't deduct it anymore. How does that figure in when I'm paying, or I have to pay the tax on the distribution for last year?
I believe that a portion of the non-taxable and a portion of the taxable go with it. And I'm going to have to plead the fifth without re-looking it up, because when you convert, generally when you're converting a traditional, you're converting all taxable dollars and it's all totally taxable. And I believe that it's a portion, but I'm not positive of that. So I would suggest there is a publication 590 that is an IRA publication. And there will be a worksheet that shows you that. And just off the top of my head, without thinking about it, I know that there's some special rules, and I believe it is partly taxable and partly non-taxable that goes over. And obviously, you wouldn't pay taxes on the non-taxable part. It would become your basis, additional basis in the Roth. But I would double-check that to make sure that that's not the case, you know, that you can't just take one or the other. I believe it's a proportion part. But I would, like I say, check it out, because without looking it up, I don't remember off the top.
Okay. There you go, Joan. Check it out. Joshua in Lake Geneva, hello to you.
Hi there. So my question is, I have three W-2s this year. I just got a new job at a farm, and when I was doing my taxes, I had put in my first two W-2s, and my refund amount for federal was pretty average. And I put in my third one with the new farm job, and it has all of a sudden dropped by about $600. And I've only been working here for 3 months. So I guess my question is, does working at a farm affect that or anything like that? Or I just really want to know why it dropped.
Okay, the farm itself doesn't change. Whether your W-2 comes from the farm or a manufacturing unit or whatever, it doesn't change that. But when you look at your farm W-2, do you have any withholding on that W-2?
Honestly, I don't have it right in front of me, so I'm not entirely sure.
Okay, my guess is that you had to add income into it and did not have withholding from it. I mean, that can be the case. And so that additional income caused tax and you didn't have anything left to pay taxes on it, you know, to help offset the tax. That would be my guess of what happened in that situation. So check your boxes to see if there was any state or federal withholding. And if there isn't, that's the reason that it happened.
And if you correct me if I'm wrong on this, Mary, but even if you claimed yourself as a dependent or, you know, to take that portion, if the income was quite a bit smaller than the others,
they wouldn't be taking any withholding out.
Yeah, they wouldn't be taking anything out.
Right. But sometimes in farm businesses, because of the industry not being a normal industry with normal employees and things,
yeah,
they may not have taken the state or federal withholding out. But I would guess that that's the situation.
Yeah. So there you go, Josh. If you continue with that, you might want to just keep that in mind for next year, maybe save a few extra bucks off to the side to cover those taxes. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. John in Mount Horeb. Hi.
Yes, thank you. I wonder if Mary could talk briefly about donor-advised funds. I believe a donor-advised funds is an approach to making charitable contributions in an effective way. I wonder if Mary could talk about the advantages and or disadvantages of a donor-advised fund.
A donor advised fund is a way of putting money away and taking the charitable contribution now for the amount that you're putting away, and maybe not deciding until later where exactly that money's going. The donor advised funds has to be a charity or a nonprofit, has to be set up as such, and you tell them where and when the money goes to the charity. So positive side of it is it lets you put away a lot more than maybe you would otherwise. It is a good thing that happens, for instance, if you sell something and have a large gain on the sale or a lot of income in 1 year and you want to reduce that income, you can put it away in a donor-advised fund and then decide who gets it later on. That's the positive side of it. The IRS tends to not like those as well. Not that it's illegal, but they tend to watch them because you're taking a deduction that did not exactly go directly to the charity at that time. So that's kind of my concern. Be sure if you're getting involved with the donor advised funds, you've researched them and find, you know, that they're good funds that are good companies that you're dealing with. There is a drawback, though. When we talked about the qualified charitable deduction, you cannot take money from your IRA and go directly into a donor advised fund. That's one of the things that's not allowed.
All right. John, does that help?
All right. That helps. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Ted in West Allis, your turn. Hi, Ted.
Yeah, just quickly, that person I called about not having to file taxes because their income is so low and they're retired, the one thing I would say about that is that that person can still qualify for the homestead credit if they're paying property taxes. So in that case, what you would do, I just had mine done yesterday, is you would fill out or submit a federal return, which is, you know, basically zero taxes being returned to you or whatever, but you still qualify for the homestead credit, and you can still get that credit refunded to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The problem in Nancy's case is that her mother was no longer paying any rent. And so there was nothing to base the homestead credit on. But you're correct. You homestead credit is based on your total income, whether it's taxable income or non-taxable income. But you must have paid property taxes or rent to an organization that is also paying rent. Sometimes with the homesteads, when people go into nursing homes or assisted living facilities, if those nursing homes or assisted living facilities are tax exempt and don't pay any property taxes, even then the rent you pay doesn't qualify for it.
Ted, thanks again. Appreciate it. Norman from Land O'Lakes emailed to ask, when reporting health insurance expenses as a subtraction, does he need to reduce his health insurance cost by the amount of the refund he received, or should he simply report the gross amount he pays for health insurance coverage?
The health insurance deduction can be taken in two places. Health insurance is a deduction on Schedule A if you can itemize and get over the 7.5% of your adjusted gross and then can itemize. On Wisconsin, the health insurance deduction is a direct deduction. And so the refund that you get with that doesn't come into play. But on your Schedule A, if you are itemizing with your Schedule A, that health insurance comes off of the Schedule A deductions for Wisconsin purposes. So you're not going to double dip. You can have it as an itemized deduction on Wisconsin or not. You can take it as a direct deduction on Wisconsin, but you can't use it twice for the Wisconsin credit.
Gotcha. John in Wausau emailed to ask, is insurance claim money from weather-related property damage received in 2019, is that a taxable income?
If you have a casualty loss to personal property, as long as you have put that money back into the property, it's not going to be a taxable event. If you are in a business and receive money for it, then it will be a taxable event.
All right. And Jim emailed to ask about virtual currencies. His daughter has started paying him for things using her iPhone. Are those not virtual because they begin, end, and always are always in U.S. dollars? Any virtual currencies like crypto currencies?
I'm not sure how his daughter is paying him. It sounds like she may be paying him bank account-wise, sending money from her bank account to his bank account.
So, yeah.
That's not virtual currency. That's U.S. dollars, just instead of reach out and touch, it's just going over the wires, so to speak. Virtual currency, the most common that people recognize is something called bitcoins.
Yeah.
And if you engage in that kind of either as investment or for using it, what the government is saying is that it's like stock. You've bought a piece of property. When you use it, if there's a change in value of that property, you have to report it as a gain or a loss. And so that's where it gets into the virtual currency.
All right. Well, that's that makes sense. In the last 30 seconds, anything else you want to leave us with in terms of changes or otherwise?
The latest tax law changes at the end of the year did involve the RMD situation, and one of the biggest changes for RMD is that starting in 2020, people do not have to take their RMDs until age 72 rather than age 70 and a half. Didn't change anything for anybody in back years, but if you are turning 70 and a half in 2020, you don't have to take your RMD until you turn 72. So that's food for thought coming up.
Mary, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. I have it. You'll be back March 17th.
I will.
Well, thank you again. I really appreciate it. You do a wonderful job. Thank you so much.
You are very welcome.
Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. They're enrolled agents. Always great to have her with us. She's back March 17th. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the amazing history and current conservation efforts of tortoises on the Galapagos Islands. So I hope you can join us for that. In the meantime, you know what? There's lots more good things in store here right through the afternoon. So please stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller.